From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, the United States will hit President Biden's goal of administering 100 million doses of coronavirus vaccine. It'll happen more than a month earlier than he'd planned. More than 12% of the population is now fully vaccinated against the disease, though about 1,000 Americans are still dying of it every day.
Meanwhile, President Biden and Vice President Harris are mourning another tragedy. They're in Atlanta today to meet with Asian American community leaders and state lawmakers after Tuesday's shootings at spas there that left 8 people dead, 6 of them women of Asian descent. We're going to convene our Friday roundtable now. Kimberly Atkins is a columnist with the Boston Globe. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Also with us, Rick Klein, ABC political director. Hello, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
I think it's safe to say a lot of people around the country are scared, especially in Asian American communities that are calling on the government and leaders to pay more attention to the racism and sexism they have experienced. Kimberly, what do people want to hear from the president today?
Yes, I think, you know, it's moments like this when the events in and around Atlanta really strike and hit hard and are traumatic, particularly after a year where we have focused and seen so much of the racial divisions in this country at times spill out violently and fatally. And so this is a moment where a president has to step up and be a healer, to speak in a way that shows that he understands what Asian Americans are feeling, what women are feeling, women of color are feeling on a day where an attack like that happened. He seemed to step carefully yesterday, using his words, saying that the investigation was ongoing. Today, clearly, he acknowledges that he needs to do more, and that's what we'll be looking to see.
And Rick, this is the first time the president has had to confront something that every other recent president has had to confront, and that is a mass shooting. How do you think he's going to approach this?
Yeah, it's so interesting because this event was originally scheduled to be a COVID-19 event to try to get the word out about the package that was approved and what needs to be done. And it's morphed into a different kind of consoler-in-chief type of event. And in some ways, this is what Joe Biden is made of. He's very good at this. He's got a lot of experience with personal tragedy and in situations like this. I'm also interested to see Vice President Harris as the first female vice president, also the first woman of color, first woman of Asian American descent to be vice president. I feel like she has a special role in this, and it is a big moment because this is a country that's still reeling from a whole host of racially charged divisions over the last couple of years, and we've seen those highlighted by the tragic events this week.
Rick, even without this shooting, it has been a pretty tough week for the White House. They're dealing with a surge of unaccompanied kids coming to the southern border. Republicans have been trying now for days, and we've been reporting on this, trying to hammer Democrats to make it a political liability. But have we heard any ideas from Republicans about how to actually solve this problem?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, they have been heavy on the blame, but pretty light on specific recommendations. I think it's a false narrative to say this is all Biden's fault. It's also false to say that none of it has to do with the fact that we have a new administration and with new policies. But you can see how delicate these issues are and the fact that it's taken a while for this administration, even though I think it's pretty clear on its policy goals, to find out a good process. They've inherited policies and processes that were in almost the exact opposite of where they want to go. You heard the president directly this week tell would-be migrants, do not come, don't come. That's not the message necessarily that's being heard by them back home, where many of them are coming from just awful circumstances, hoping for a better life and expecting that they'll get a more compassionate treatment from President Biden. So I feel like a lot is on the White House now to start to deliver on some kind of policy prescriptions with the Secretary of Homeland Security down at the border and with a lot of lawmakers starting to call this a crisis, even if the White House has resisted that term.
Well, exactly. And Kimberly, the House is trying. What about that bill, actually two bills, that the House passed yesterday that would create a pathway for citizenship for about 4 million immigrants in the country illegally? Democrats did something interesting here. Instead of a big, comprehensive immigration reform package, they tried to see if they could get Republicans to come along by focusing on young immigrants or dreamers, and then also farm workers. What do you think about that?
Yes, I mean, history, very recent history has shown us that big comprehensive immigration reform is very difficult, if not impossible, to do on Capitol Hill, even when there is bipartisan support for some aspects of it. So Democrats are taking the approach of breaking that apart, sort of pushing forward proposals that some Republicans have shown support for in the past. It still remains to be seen if those same Republicans will show support for it now. The Congress has changed. It's more evenly divided. The Senate is as evenly divided as one can get. And so immigration remains a very, very difficult road to hoe for at any time, but particularly now. So it's not a given that any of these may see the light of day, given those partisan divisions. But Democrats are trying to be as surgical as they can.
And these bills have renewed a call among some Democrats to abolish the filibuster. President Biden was asked about that topic in an interview earlier this week. And here's what he told ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
But here's the choice. I don't think you have to eliminate the filibuster. You have to do it what it used to be when I first got to the Senate and back in the old days when you used to be around there. And that is that a filibuster, you had to stand up and command the floor.
And Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said that if Democrats do away with the filibuster, they'll regret it. Here he is speaking in the Senate earlier this week.
Nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like.
Rick, what do you think? First off, explain what a change to the filibuster would be and what it would mean.
Yeah, it was a major statement by the president, but it wouldn't actually change the threshold the way that he's outlined it in that interview with my colleague George Stephanopoulos. You would still need 60 votes to advance legislation, but the difference is you would force members of the minority party to speak during the entire time, have to defend themselves, explain themselves before the American people. In practice, it would slow down all other business to an effective halt. But the idea is that it would make the minority party really choose its battles wisely, and I think carefully. And I think right now the possibility of a talking filibuster over voting rights reform, when so many states are trying to limit access to the ballot box, the House has passed and the Senate is likely to pass in the next couple of weeks an expansion in voting rights. That could be where the rubber hits this road. Right now, the votes are not in the Senate to change the rules to make a 60-vote threshold, a 50-vote threshold, but it might be there to change it and clarify that you actually have to engage in the full-on Mr. Smith goes to Washington-style filibuster if you want to block something.
Versus just sit in your chair and say nothing?
Right. Well, what's happened over the years is that it's become kind of a gentleman's agreement that if the party says, hey, we want a 60-vote threshold, they give it to them to avoid having to go through the motions. This would formalize it and say, no, you know what? If you want to block something, having a minority, then you have to stand on the floor and hold it and keep on talking for hours or even days.
Kimberly, it's not just the House immigration bills that have been languishing. How big is the legislative pileup getting outside the Senate right now?
It's getting very big, and it's really important to issues, things such as voting rights and police reform and expanding protections for LGBTQ Americans. It's a lot of civil rights legislation. And getting back to the issue of the filibuster, if you look at history, the filibuster has been used time and time again to thwart civil rights legislation. So I'm not particularly sure that the minority party will not take every opportunity to stand and speak for however long it takes, even if the talking filibuster is brought back. There are other things that can be done. The Senate can change rules in other ways. It can exempt civil rights legislation, for example, from that cloture requirement, the same way they have for some presidential nominees for cabinets and for the judiciary. So there are other tools in the shed that can be used here. I think that it's very interesting that Mitch McConnell is talking about scorched earth now when many of the rules regarding cloture and the filibuster over the years have been changed under his direction.
Rick Klein, I'd mentioned at the top there that President Biden hit that 100 million vaccine goal. I think it was more than a month earlier than he had promised. What do you think about that? Is that a sign of a job well done or a case of a politician under-promising and then celebrating the victory?
We were on track to get to that number almost certainly, with or without the president's commitment. But he does deserve a degree of credit for picking up the pace, picking up the urgency, using some tools of government to make sure that this was happening as quickly as possible. I do think this was a case of under-promising and then over-delivering, but that doesn't change the fact that this is a major milestone and that we are further along right now, 50-some-odd days into the first 100 days, than we were on track to be when President Biden took office.
Yeah. All right. Rick Klein is ABC News political director. We've also been speaking with Kimberly Atkins, a columnist with the Boston Globe. Thanks to you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Musician Billy Strings is only 28 years old, but the Michigan-born guitarist already has his first Grammy. His album Home won Best Bluegrass Album on Sunday night. Here's the title track.
Alone for a while with myself, I feel so at home in the shade.
Billy Strings joins me now from his tour bus. Billy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And congratulations. What was that like to win your first Grammy?
It's unreal, man. I've been on the road for like the past 10 years, you know, playing, man, almost 200 gigs a year. And it's made me really reflect on everything we've been through the last few years.
Tell me about this journey for you over the last 28 years of your life led up to this moment. Like, how did you get here? Was music in your family growing up?
Yeah, it absolutely was. My dad is a wonderful guitar player and singer and plays a lot of bluegrass music, but he can play anything, you know, rock and roll and stuff like that. But it was always bluegrass too, you know. I think maybe through his grandfather or father, somebody turned him on to Bill Monroe, and by the time I was 4 years old, I had a guitar and he taught me some chords, and my dad would play all the fancy licks and I just played rhythm.
Did you have an aha moment, like, oh yeah, like I'm good, or I just figured this thing out?
I think that moment really happened when I was about 6 years old. I'm going to paint you a portrait in words here. Little trailer, little bedroom in the back. Me and my dad are sitting there in our underwear playing bluegrass music, and he's trying to teach me chords and stuff, and I'm 6 years old. We're playing Beaumont Rag, which is this old fiddle tune, and I always messed up the chords. I was frustrated, and I just go, stop, just dad, just stop. And I'm like, why don't you just play it and just let me listen? And so he did. He played the melody, and instead of holding the chord and counting to four and then going to the next chord and counting to four. So instead of thinking about it like that, I listened to what his guitar was saying. It was like, you know, do 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 diddle diddle do diddle diddle do diddle diddle do diddle diddle do. After that, I was like, okay, let me try it again. Now that I really got the melody in my head, and I freaking nailed it. And he was so proud. He just leaned over and like squeezed my little hand, and that moment has pushed me to this day. I mean, I still think about that. And like the other day when we won the Grammy, who did I call? I called my dad, you know, right away. Look, Dad, you taught me well.
And you know, the first time I heard of you, I saw your name, Billy Strings, and I was like, Billy Strings, that can't be his real name. That's too perfect. Where'd that name come from?
Well, it came from my Aunt Mondi, she's not really my aunt. She's just one of my mom's best friends. You know, she's the one that gave me that nickname when I was, like, just a little kid. She just said it one time. Look at little Billy Strings over there trying to play with all the big dogs. And later on, when I was a teenager, I went to visit her when she was on her deathbed. And somebody told her we were there, and she got out of bed. She come out to the garage, and it wasn't long before the guitars got busted out, you know, because Mondi always wanted to hear us play. Man, it was just this crazy thing. I mean, she hadn't drank in 4 or 5 years, and she's been sick, and she's just been laying in bed. And, you know, we start playing music, and she gets up and starts dancing, and she grabs the joint and starts hitting it, and she cracks a beer. And she's like, I haven't drank in 4 years, you know? And it was just amazing. And we sat there and just played all night, man.
Yeah.
And she died not long after that. And that was around the same time that in Traverse City, I was just beginning to like play open mic nights and stuff. And after she died, when I went up to the chalkboard to write my name up there, I wrote Billy Strings, you know, in her honor.
Well, Billy, I think Mondy knew what she was doing with that name. I think she got it pretty spot on. Why don't we listen to some of your music? Because we read that you actually spent a lot of time in heavy metal bands as a teenager, and I think we can kind of hear that at the end of your song Home on the album. Let's listen. You know what's interesting about your music? I feel like we actually hear a lot of different genres in there, not just traditional bluegrass.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised on bluegrass, but I also, you know, by the time I was 10 or 11, my dad got me an electric guitar. And that's when I started learning about Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and Johnny Winter, Yes, and, you know, Pink Floyd. And that made a big impact, especially Johnny Winter's guitar playing, you know, and the psychedelia of Pink Floyd was really interesting. You know, like as a young kid with a very imaginative mind, listening to the album The Dark Side of the Moon was like watching a movie.
Huh. Well, it's not all genre mixing here, right? Let's listen to another song called Hollow Heart, in which you say you were trying to write an old bluegrass song. Here it is.
You might never settle down. Well, I spent a lifetime waiting for you while you were running around the town. You'll always have a place with me, dear, a place inside this hollow heart of mine. But it's all right, my little darling.
You know, we do a lot of stuff, like you said, where there's different genres and there's, you know, weird sounds and effects. But I like to also always have some pure bluegrass in there, almost like a palate cleanser, I guess.
Yeah. You know, to my ear, Home is actually filled with other songs that are quite dark. For example, there's this one. It's called Enough to Leave.
Enough to kill you, enough to put you down. Seem like every way you turn is like a hard wind coming down. Enough to leave me here.
You wrote that for two friends of yours, I understand, who died as a result of taking heroin laced with fentanyl, and I'm going to ask you about that in just a minute if you don't mind. But first, there's also this track called Guitar Piece. It's instrumental, and it also has a somber feel to it. Tell me what you were trying to do here.
I pretty much got high and turned on the mics and tried to come up with something on the spot. I was watching this George Harrison documentary where there was a lot of him and like Ravi Shankar doing just kind of stream of consciousness playing, you know? And I wanted to do something like that. So I just smoked a bunch of weed and tried to put something out.
Does that help you in the creative process? Because I know some artists are kind of conflicted about that.
Yeah, I think so. As soon as I would smoke a little bit, I'd be like, man, where's my guitar? You know, and I'd just go find it and just go play.
Do you think you could do it as well without the drugs?
Yeah, I don't know if it just helps me get into the mood of the song or the emotion or what, you know. I mean, there's been several times in the last few years where I did stop smoking, and I don't think it affected my music at all.
Yeah, no judgment for me. I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I do want to ask you about something else related to drugs, and this is serious. I said before that some of your friends had died of an overdose, and I just want to see if you'd be willing to talk about that for a moment and tell me how they inspired your music.
Well, yeah, that song, Enough to Leave, I wrote that after two of my friends died of a heroin overdose within probably a week of each other. One friend was this girl who I went to elementary school with, and my other buddy was kind of responsible for almost getting me into the scene that I'm in now. Man, I was just crushed, you know? So I just sat down and wrote that song and kind of wanted to do something for him, and that's kind of all I know how to do.
I give you diamonds, I give you rings and pearls. If you could stay a while with me and just hold on to this world.
Billy Strings, before I let you go, you're speaking to us from your tour bus. I mean, you're about to perform in Florida. What's that like? I mean, because this whole year for artists has been very complicated and really difficult, being locked up. Are you back on the road?
I'm back on the road in a sense. We're playing one in Florida where there's, you know, socially distanced sort of pods. And then when we go to New Orleans and play, like, there's nobody there. You know, they're just live streaming shows. So, like, you know, we're on tour, but we're still playing for the internet. We are doing some of those socially distanced events, and it's going to be incredible. I can't wait to play for people again. That's what I do. I know it's a release for a lot of those folks, as it is for me. Just getting able to get together with my band and play music is such a blessing.
Well, why don't we go out listening to some more from your Grammy Award-winning bluegrass album, Home. Billy Strings, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully I'll see you out there somewhere.
Cold, cold ashes on the ground. Nothing lost and nothing found. Friends and loved ones falling down.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Ariel Waldman spent weeks peering into the Antarctic ice through her microscope.
It's really brimming with life. It's just that most of it is invisible to us.
Traveling Through the Looking Glass. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The Biden administration is canceling $1 billion worth of student loans. The cancellation covers 72,000 borrowers who previously had their loans partly forgiven. Now all the debt is gone. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
Well, we should say that this news covers a relatively small group of borrowers, people who went to a school that either closed suddenly or somehow defrauded their students. What do we need to know about it?
Well, if you remember back a few years, there were some scandals involving for-profit higher education companies such as Corinthian Colleges and ITT Technical Institute. Both of them have actually closed since then amid a lot of fraud allegations. So what this does is it basically relieves any borrowers who took out federal loans to attend these schools. It forgives 100% of the loans. It also allows them to get reimbursed in many cases for money that they've paid back, and also requests credit bureaus to remove sort of the negative credit reports that they may have incurred by being late on these loans. And finally, Peter, it reinstates these students' eligibility to apply for new federal student aid if they need it and they were late on these loans.
Under the Trump administration, those people did have some of their debt forgiven, but not all of it. So why is Biden now stepping in with a more generous offer?
So the Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, had a statement out, and he said basically that the department made a close review of these claims and all the evidence, and that they determined that these borrowers really had been harmed, and they wanted to grant them a fresh start. He said they deserve a simplified and fair path to relief when they have been harmed by the misconduct of these schools. And it kind of goes back to sort of the intention of the Obama-era policy that started all of this. Mm-hmm.
So that applies to people who were defrauded by their colleges. But let's dig into what this means for everyone else. President Biden says he's willing to forgive up to $10,000 of debt per person. Progressive Democrats, though, want him to go even further. Catch us up on that debate and if it would take an act of Congress to do anything like that.
Well, that is the debate. Many progressives are hoping Biden can just issue an executive order for this. He has responded that he thinks Congress really needs to do it. And I think it kind of just gets back to the idea that Joe Biden's a little bit more to the center than the really progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And he's probably worried a little bit about pushback against this from conservatives who will start bringing up the federal deficit and the federal debt again now that it's swollen because of all the programs related to the pandemic.
Okay, to that point, 45 million Americans have student loan debt. Adds up to approximately something like $1.7 trillion. It's a lot of money. And as you say, Mike, not everyone thinks the government should be responsible for helping people pay off their student loans.
Right. I think to make the case for why it could or should be done, obviously, if you graduated from school in the last 10 or 12 years, you had a lot of headwinds facing you from the financial crisis and then the pandemic. And add on top of that how obscenely expensive it is to pay for college, that I think the argument is that this could be a real good boost to the economy if you were able to forgive a lot of student loans and let people spend that money elsewhere.
Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Have a great weekend.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo is leaving Houston to take the top job in the Miami Police Department. Acevedo calls himself a change agent, and he got national attention last summer when he stood in solidarity with people protesting the death of one-time Houston resident George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. He referenced that time in a news conference he held this week to announce his move to Miami.
And I would challenge any member of the community, if they look at how the summer of protests across this country, where we saw buildings burning and just so many bad things happening, to compare the performance of our department to a lot of other departments.
Chief Art Acevedo is in Houston on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Sure, and congratulations on the new job. And before we dig into the events of last summer, I do want to ask you, why are you moving?
Because, you know, policing's in my, it's really in my DNA. I've been, yesterday was my 35th anniversary of when I started the academy. So it's, I'm now, you know, moving in my 36th year since the academy. And my mayor's termed out. He'll be leaving in a couple of years. And this opportunity came out of nowhere. I think Miami's an amazing city. As a Cuban, a refugee whose journey into this beautiful country and the freedom that this country brought us started in Miami. It's kind of like coming full circle. And by leaving, I'm also creating an opportunity for one of my executive assistant chiefs to get their opportunity to lead and serve this beautiful community.
There's been a lot of attention in Houston to the police killings in recent years. In Houston, six residents have been killed by police in 6 years. About the police cam videos of the shootings, you say you're a reformer, but why did you block the release of video in the shootings that involved police there?
Because, you know, the number one responsibility we have as police executives is to ensure that we conduct and we have a process and a system that's in place, and we follow that process to ensure that we, A, get to the truth as it relates to what occurred, B, leave no stone unturned in that pursuit, no stone in our pursuit to find the good, the bad, and the ugly. And C, in the event that there is misconduct by the officers, either administrative or criminal, that we do nothing to jeopardize our ability to hold those individuals accountable.
I have to say, it sounds like you're making a good case for releasing the video.
We have a new a DA here that came in. She's okay with us releasing videos. And we have our system in place to roll with that, and we're just waiting for our mayor to actually give the green light.
Chief, I want to look back at last summer's protests over the death of George Floyd. Many cities across the country saw violence, the burning of buildings. I wonder, when you expressed support for the protesters, which made so much news, you're taking that stand, your police department did end up arresting more than 600 people during the first week of protests. How do you square supporting the protesters and then seeing hundreds of them put under arrest by your department? Can you sync those two?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're all about supporting First Amendment activity and the right to protest as long as people don't go on the freeway, because we saw, I explained to my community, when you go on a freeway, we can't protect you. And after having a really intense, you know, interaction with a big group of protesters that wanted to go on the freeway, I think a few days later, we saw what happened in Minneapolis or somewhere where an 18-wheeler ran over a bunch of protesters. And the other piece is, you don't get to start breaking windows, and you don't get to start throwing rocks, and you don't get to vandalize. You know, First Amendment activity is about protest, and criminal activity is about vandalism and violence, and we cannot tolerate that.
When you talk about being a reformer, we should say that the attempts you have made to reduce homicides in Houston are questionable now, because you yourself have said that the city can expect 500 more homicides in the next year. Is that an admission that your efforts have failed?
No, that's an admission that we have a problem. When you look across this nation, we are seeing a quick and sudden rise in homicides, significant spike in homicides from New York to Los Angeles to Milwaukee to just about every city, small and large, and that's a problem. And there's a multitude of factors that have caused that. A significant rise from the impact of COVID to the impact of the courts not working because of COVID to reformist and I would call activist judges and prosecutors that rather than making decisions based on the type of crimes committed, they're treating everyone like they're a shoplifter, including murderers. And therein lies part of the problem. So you have to have all parts of the criminal justice system and our partners working together. Otherwise, this is heading in the wrong direction. And it's not just here in Houston. It's across the country.
So what are you going to do to try and burnish your reputation as a reformer? And I know you like to call yourself a change agent. What are you going to do to assure that you are one when you get to Miami?
Well, I think that when I start continuing to look at my new city, that my coming back home to a city where this journey started is – there is still a lot of room to build community trust. There's a concern about the level of accountability there, and I hope that we will put robust systems in place so when there's malfeasance, we uncover it, we prevent it, uncover it if it happens, and hold people accountable that we deliver that kind of constitutionally respectful service to the people of Miami, regardless of what neighborhood they live in, what color of their skin, gender, sexual orientation, or what their level of economic, where they're at the socioeconomic ladder.
Chief Art Acevedo, thank you, and we wish you good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
More demonstrators were reportedly killed by security forces in Myanmar today. Opposition to the February coup that ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's democratically elected government remains strong, but security forces are intensifying their efforts to squash it, with more than 200 protesters killed so far. Michael Sullivan reports from neighboring Thailand.
This week has been the bloodiest since the anti-coup protests began, starting with security forces killing at least 40 demonstrators in the Yangon suburb of Lang Thorat. That same day, several Chinese-run factories were torched in the same neighborhood. It's not clear by whom. Min Zha-U is an analyst at the Myanmar Institute for Peace and Security in Yangon.
The Myanmar general public and the opposition largely believe Chinese government assisting the Myanmar military. That's a widespread perception.
A military that responded quickly and brutally after Sunday's arson attacks, especially after China's foreign ministry demanded its citizens and its property be protected. By Monday night, martial law had been declared in more than half a dozen townships. This week, the regime also targeted local and international NGOs it accused of helping fund the protesters.
So what the regime is doing is pretty much consolidating its presence and cracking down the protests and arresting the organizers and any elements that they consider will challenge the regime.
That includes journalists, nearly 40 detained since the coup, including one today from the BBC. A half dozen media outlets have also been shut down. And the junta also cut mobile data service this week, preventing protesters from using their phones to live stream the protest and the security forces' crackdown to the world. But the shutdown hasn't stopped those images or the people's outrage from getting out. Like this woman, after learning that her 17-year-old son, a medical student, had been shot and killed in the Yangon suburb of Tamway. They murdered him, she cries. They shot him three times. Three times. He wasn't even 18 years old. Not even 18. And the throttling of the internet hasn't stopped citizens from posting videos of the security forces threatening people either. Like this one from the Yangon suburb of North Okolapa on Wednesday. Security forces had just removed a makeshift barricade erected by protesters to slow the police and army down. Attention, everyone who lives on the street, the officer bellows. If we come back and find another barricade here, we will uproot the whole neighborhood and shoot everyone. On the seventh week of the coup, Myanmar's military clearly has the protesters reeling, wondering what to do next. For its part, the junta has given striking civil servants, doctors, nurses, teachers, etc., an ultimatum. Back to work by Monday or face lengthy jail terms. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
This Sunday will mark 1 year since the U.S. and Canada closed their shared border to non-essential crossings due to the pandemic. The Department of Homeland Security says the border will remain closed until at least April 21st. In the meantime, every weekend, rain or shine, Peace Arch Park in Blaine in Washington State becomes a meetup spot for families and couples separated by a border. The Northwest News Network's Tom Bonsi takes us there.
Before the pandemic, you'd find around 50 people visiting Peace Arch State Park on a late winter weekend afternoon. But last weekend, more than 1,000 spread out across the manicured lawns of this cross-border park, three generations of the Wilson family among them.
This is Jack Wilson. I'm the grandpa of the group.
Jack is from Nanaimo, Vancouver Island. His descendants live on both sides of the border, including a new baby granddaughter from Chehalis, Washington.
And first time of seeing that little girl in our life. And so it means a lot to us just to get together. And it's been a long time since we've been together as a family. So it's been well over a year now.
The Wilson clan came prepared for a full day at the border park, bringing with them a portable fire pit, camping chairs, blankets, a picnic, and storybooks.
Yeah, it was so fun. I got to see my family and my little cousin and everyone.
6-year-old American Zoe and her Canadian grandpa Jack say they're grateful a kind of neutral zone exists between the two countries.
Well, we've been saying all along we could always fly down and see them, but the time factor, and then we would have to, because the COVID quarantine on both ends of the trip. And since I run my own business, it was just out of reach.
The Peace Arch Park meetups exist within an unwritten loophole. There's no wall on the border here, not even a fence. Canadians can get together with their American loved ones on the U.S. side of the day-use park by stepping across a shallow ditch. U.S. Border Patrol and Canadian police officers, such as Phil Taze, keep watch to make sure people leave the park the way they came in.
Well, it's not neutral at all. It's super clear. Like, the border is by this ditch. Anything south of this is the United States. Anything north of this is Canada. It's just a bit of a loophole for people to be able to come back and forth. But all the rules still apply.
British Columbia legislators who represent the border towns of Surrey and White Rock want Washington State to close its side of Peace Arch Park. Canada shut down its half last summer because of the crowds and coronavirus transmission concerns. U.S. Park Ranger Rick Blank says if people follow the rules by keeping their distance from other visitors, keeping gatherings small, the park can stay open safely. Blank says people converge on this place from throughout Canada and the United States.
Well, I mean, I've had people drive from Montana, Texas, Arizona, I mean, all over.
Not even mud and winter cold deter them. On snowy Valentine's weekend, Blank counted 78 tents that couples and families pitched during the day for shelter and privacy.
My leadership and above me all thought, oh, it's going to stop when it rains and gets cold and stuff like that. And I said, no, you know, people connections are more important, you know, than a border. And this is not going to stop.
Mill Creek, Washington resident Will Shin says he drives to the border park just about every week to see his Canadian fiancée. She comes down from Vancouver. Shin is hopeful the border will reopen when more people get vaccinated against COVID-19.
Until now, like, it was a little unclear how we were going to get out of it. But, like, now with the vaccine, I think there's light, you know, there's light kind of off in the distance. Like, how we're going to get there is still remains to be determined.
Canadian and U.S. officials have been extending the northern border closure month to month. Neither government has provided the metrics they're using to judge when it's safe to ease up. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Blaine, Washington.
If you're looking for a new playlist for the weekend, how about the latest from outer space? That sound is coming from the surface of Mars. NASA scientists say that's what it sounds like as the Perseverance rover moves at about 4.5 centimeters per second across the planet's Jezero crater. The rover landed there on February 18th. It's equipped with two microphones, and Perseverance will be assembling a sort of Martian top 10 list of audio. NASA says this sound is the clanking of metal wheels on the Martian surface. There's also a scratching sound, and scientists don't know what that is yet. For most of us, it's just fascinating to hear sounds from another world, but for scientists, this audio recording can help them better understand Mars. They say it gives them clues to how hard or porous the rocks are. Sound is just a part of the mission. Perseverance also has a small helicopter on board that will start test flights soon. And after that, the real mission begins, searching for signs of past life on Mars. And if they happen to find a little green man, we hope they record an interview with those microphones. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.